here's this thing you could listen to. Sure. I mean, the internet is the speeding up of telecommunications. It's complete. It's linear in that sense. It's a graphically organized document, and it's not spatial. In virtual space is not spatial in the same way that, you know, quote unquote, real space is space. So you have translating political space into virtual space, politicized. It's kind of, it doesn't translate perfectly. So there's that. And, but to go on to this distinction between the public and private, I think that's really important, that it seems, and it seems that though this CBC forum or blog would have been an exception, which is, I think that's fascinating. I didn't know about that. That's a sort of natural, what I was going to say was there's no natural virtual space. It's all constructed. And when you have a constructed space, you have someone who needs to construct it and maintain it. So when you were asking me or before about free speech golden ages and about whether they were on the internet, I just think about growing up on the internet in the mid to late 2000s and having people all, you know, in these like forum culture wars, kind of like you've got the mods who always come in and shut down the discussion because it just gets too heated, you know, but that's that those moderators will always be there because that had to be constructed. The internet is always an artificial space that has to be built and moderated and maintained by these people. So to have this kind of natural virtual space like CBC, where people are afforded the right, the positive right to speak at this place.
As someone with some of a background in computer science and had to learn a little bit about the psychology of design, I do want to push back a little bit to what Mihai was saying about, like, you know, we talk online because, and this goes a little bit to Brandon's point of, like, we build these systems, and because we don't talk online, we type online, we type at each other. And a lot of the social cues you have for not saying something of a certain kind, or respect for rules, respect for other people, even if it's simple, like there's an authority figure present on the internet, you can make yourself anonymous, you can go to places without rules. Under those conditions, I think there is no place that you could argue better for the evidence and the truth of the Hobbesian belief that the natural state of humanity is the war of all against all. That is, you know, what probably the most despicable thing I'll ever say on the Canadian Philosophy Show. That the internet has basically proven to us that if you create a space without rules, without structure, designed in such a way that people can type whatever they want to each other, then paradoxically, what they will type at each other is the things that will emotionally influence people the fastest and the most and the quickest. And those are, in fact, probably the most least useful things you can ever say. By definition, like as people who study philosophy, as are trying to, you know, engage in dialogue and discussion and truly trying to understand different perspectives, we understand that we can't just, you know, say something emotionally scarring or annoying for the purpose of getting a reaction. And if we engaged in that kind of behavior, it would be detrimental to our very discussion on this program. I guess I'm arguing that we need laws.
I'm going to ask you, though, so do you think this, like, talking online is speech?
From a technical perspective, it shouldn't be considered speech. It should be considered what it is, which is written word, and written word created within a specific environment. Fundamentally speaking, the internet hasn't been set up for verbal dialogue. It was never set up to do that. The World Wide Web that came out of CERN was designed to share research documents. And we've come a long way through from there, but all web pages are still made in HTML, which is fundamentally designed to share Word documents and to be a 2D text description of things. So we're limited by that.
I'm going to push back on you just a little bit here, which is that this free speech discussion doesn't just cover spoken word. And so one of the people that was on this debate panel is actually currently suing X Twitter over the censorship of a movie that he made based on one of his books that critiques big corporations and has to do with this discussion around free speech and all that kind of thing. And Twitter banned his movie, censored him. And he is suing them. He's a law professor at UBC, and he is suing them for this behavior. And so when we're talking about free speech, I want to be clear that we're not just talking about spoken word. We're also talking about things like books, movies, all of that. Our ability to put out information, I think, is relevant. Another thing is that on these social media platforms, we also do talk because we record videos of ourselves, right? So it's not that we talk to each other in the same way we talk in person, but we have the capacity to monologue, let's say, and to present our ideas in spoken, fully sort of symbolic, visual, and auditory form. And that can equally be censored. Not only that, but here's where we get into the discussion of algorithms. The fact that when I open my YouTube page, even though I would like a variety of perspectives, just because, let's say, I clicked on a couple of videos that are on a certain part of the political spectrum because I thought they might be interesting, now that's all I get. And this algorithm that's designed to please also inherently creates echo chambers and creates these bubbles where all you are receiving is stuff that you like to hear. Now, I've gotten a criticism for saying this in the sense that, you know, people tell me, oh, you can just go and find other things. It's not that you're restricted to just the things that the algorithm recommends to you. But if we're talking about, you know, equality of presence, for example, like, maybe there's something to be said about the way these algorithms, especially as they're getting smarter and more sophisticated, how they influence our capacity to reach information and how people that know how to play the algorithm game. And like you say, the most clickbaity, extreme sounding kind of material is the one that's most likely to surge and to trend because it causes these reactions and because it gets out of people. So, you know, are we at a point where because we trust our free speech, because we trust these companies and these private spheres with our free speech, are we facing the consequences of that? And is our speech becoming less free just as a result of the systems with which we're entrusting it?
YouTube is a platform. Because of the medium, because of the technology and the interactions it is created to design, and also because of the rules and guidelines and the systems that have been developed, has created a different type of speech than Twitter, which fundamentally at least used to be about writing very, very short text messages and broadcasting them to a very large number of people. Those technological design choices create different dynamics about what types of speech are possible and can spread. YouTube from day one let you build, you know, a video for any length of time that you wanted. Twitter purposefully capped you at a certain amount. And so it purposefully was like those design choices created situations where, like, you were never going to have a nuanced discussion on Twitter. It was just not physically possible. You could, but on YouTube, it's a video. You don't really usually have a discussion when it's just a monologue talking into a camera. But then we also, you know, got podcasts, we got radio, we got the internet interview format of radio, which emerged because, you know, radio used to be just all broadcasting and people talking at you, but then it became the podcasting dynamic. Which again has, you know, given a new lease on life to YouTube. So yeah, I think you've just made my point stronger that the mediums of technology that we use shape the speech that is created, and whether or not, and I think the rules for what should be considered free speech will actually depend on the type of technology that you're creating and the type of rules that you're setting up. All of this to say that, like, it is possible to create a system where free speech is impossible, where open dialogue is impossible, where creating something that will, like, the type of positive interactions that we can have as people and respect each other as people and as human beings is not possible. It's entirely possible to create that online. And if you do, we shouldn't be that surprised about the consequences when we know the psychological principles of design and visual psychology. It's not a mystery that these systems have the effects they do have. Now, what is a mystery is the scale at which these effects happen, because that's something that whenever you create a technology, you can never predict. You can never predict the ways that things will start to interact when millions and hundreds of thousands of people are using things at once.
I think Aaron is seeing different discrete forms of speech, whereas Mihai is saying, well, look at this person. You'll always, I found a counterexample. There will always be something that is unaccounted for. And so in a way, speech as a kind of whole thing can be impeded. And in a way, that kind of collapses all of your distinctions, Aaron. So that's just what I'm seeing here is, Aaron, I think you're right. There are different kinds of speeches through different forms of, you know, different media. But at the end of the day, it's all, I don't want to reduce it to mere content or anything like that. But at the end of the day, it is a political expression. And in that way, I think that's what Mihai is talking about.
I understand what you're saying, Aaron. I don't know if I'm convinced about the distinct kinds of speech that you're talking about. I recognize that each platform has its own restrictions that will create different effects, but I'm not sure I'm convinced about classifying them as distinct kinds of speech. There is something to be said about the fact that despite the fact that these are private, these are private platforms and that, you know, we can choose to engage on them or not. And the fact is that we do. And the fact is that our political figures also use these platforms to the point where, you know, world leaders make important announcements on Twitter, right? And so in that sense, they become places to discuss things that maybe were never meant to be discussed there. There is a sense in which you could see that, we should see that as problematic. And part of that is because of this sort of biasing that we get in the content that we encounter, we get this polarization effect, right? And we get these fights, these squabbles that can't be fleshed out in the way they should be because of the nature of the medium that they're in which they're taking place. And so I'm not quite sure where I sit on this, but there's this tension between trying to excuse the platforms because they were designed in a certain way and designed to have a certain effect, and recognizing the real problems behind the kinds of discussions that are happening on said platforms, right? And the implications that has for communicating with each other at large. And not, of course, the least of those problems is the fact is censorship, right? Is the fact that you can have a view and no one will hear it because people can choose to not let anyone else hear it. I guess what I'm arguing is that the digital platforms, like these media platforms, are inadvertently, or let's say, are the middleman between us and free speech sort of being choked off and, you know, becoming less free, not because of necessarily the fact that the speech on those platforms should be the most important and, you know, we shouldn't take into consideration the particularities of the medium, but that as a whole, speech is being choked as a result of the interactions that are happening on these platforms, right? And the ways we engage each other outside of these platforms may be well influenced by what happens on them, right? And what I mean, and now I want to turn that to, for example, university campuses, which I think is a really hot button sort of issue when it comes to free speech, that professors are losing jobs or they are protesting or students are protesting on the fact that university campuses are choosing to, for example, not allow certain guests to on their premises to speak or are taking down certain messaging by students or by faculty. And again, universities are not the public sphere, so they have every right to choose who they allow on their campus and who they don't. But in another sense, universities are the place where the most contentious discussions and the most, you know, nuanced and significant sharing of ideas take place in our society, right? I mean, that's what a university is. It's not just about sitting in a classroom. It's about the discussions that we have and the real impact of those discussions on what we then go out and do in the world. And so my worry is that people begin to treat live, let's say, in-person spaces like university campuses like they treat their social media page, their Discord server, their whatever. So anyway, some ideas there for someone to catch on to. And maybe what do you think? Have you seen something like that on your university campus that you want to talk about? My mind immediately goes to, in Canada, of course, we had some issues like this with some public figures like Jordan Peterson, right? Who is one of the most vocal public figures on this issue and who has been denied access to certain venues to present his ideas. So have you seen examples? What do you think of that? Am I taking this slippery slope too far?
Yeah, I'm not. So I'm kind of just, I have an idea. I don't know how committed I am to this idea yet, but I think you're absolutely right. Even though universities are private spaces, we still expect universities to be the place where educated discussion goes on. And that isn't going to happen if private interests are not serving a sort of public interest in a way. I think that's the structure of the contention. The idea that I'm not committed to, but I want to experiment with is, okay, so say Jordan Peterson is denied, denied a spot to speak on a campus about a certain issue. It still seems to happen that students will, first of all, they'll discuss this. They'll discuss whether this was good or bad. They'll also discuss the issue amongst themselves. So in a way, discussion about the issue that Peterson might have talked about isn't, the topic itself is not being purged from the campus. What needs to be done is still being done. Discussion is still happening about this. Again, I wonder about a certain obligation to recognize Peterson's capacity to contribute to this, but so this is why I'm not entirely married to the idea yet. But what I'm trying to notice here is, if universities are the places where discussion happens, even if some people are denied space to discuss it, it still seems to happen. A lot of classrooms, you know, explode still with discussions.
It's difficult, especially because the vast majority of universities in Canada have a lot of federal and provincial funding. Just like the CBC has over $1 billion of federal funding. When anyone in the private enterprise in Canada has to compete with that level of government support, if we as a society want open discourse, where people from all levels of society and not the people who are just friends with the people at the top at the CBC can have their voices and opinions heard and discussed and dialogue achieved between people, like true dialogue and exchange of ideas and hopefully like ethical improvement of human beings and of understanding. But if that's what we want Canadian society to be, then I think the universities should have a commitment to allowing debate and discussion on their campuses. Now, I think I have to qualify that by saying it's my observation that many people today are not educated in regards to debate. Like the average high schooler is not going to have a strong education in debate in their English class or necessarily in rhetoric, in speaking for themselves. So if we wish to live in a society where free speech, I think, is used in its proper way for the benefit of society, then we have to educate people to speak for themselves with good rhetoric. I honestly don't see very much of that today in Canada's education. I don't think it's something that is a high priority, is teaching youth to speak and think for themselves. We have a lot of priorities in the education space, I should say, has a lot of priorities right now. But I think that's something that we as a society have to think about, is that if we really want to have a better society, then we have to purposefully create means by which we can communicate with each other and protect those at all costs, and to train people to use those and to encourage them to.
No, I think that's fair. And I think this distinction that you brought up about positive and negative, maybe a shifting perception toward positive versus negative conceptions of this, might also be influencing my ideas, where, of course, in Canada, again, we have this protection enshrined, negative protection, but protection nonetheless. You know, there is a degree to which that is not being infringed upon nearly as much as it is elsewhere. Maybe my conception is something a little bit stronger than that, you know, or maybe I feel as if this rise in certain mediums that are being used to express our speech is stifling other mediums, or there need to be other mediums to combat these ones, right? Where we don't want to be complaining about free speech. Like, we're complaining about free speech where the only places we're talking are private companies' website platforms, digital platforms. Whereas maybe we wouldn't be having the same kind of discussion, or the same discussion at all, if we had a place like the original conception of CBC.ca, a public, nonpartisan, non-commercial platform that serves that purpose for us. Maybe things are changing. You know, maybe there is a sense in which, I think some people are noticing this, that there's a sense in which we are moving toward recognizing this need, where we are trying our best to give everyone the chance that they are, you know, the chance that they have by right to say what they want to say and communicate with each other. And we're encouraging this open discourse, right? That's the reason this whole event that I've been referencing this whole episode, that's the whole reason the event came up, is because someone, one of the, you know, university officials wanted to see a real sort of public discussion forum where we model discourse and constructive discourse so that people can know to apply it in their own lives, which I think is a really positive message. Is free speech even something that we should be talking about in this way? Is it a thing? Should we consider it a thing in and of itself? Or is it simply a means to another end? Is it that what we're really missing is we don't feel like everyone has equal access to, you know, there's a certain level of equity or equality that we're missing? Or maybe is it that we're missing, you know, talking about truth, we didn't get into this in this episode, but misinformation, right, is huge on these digital platforms, and it's a big issue. Is it that we want access to truth that we're not having? Or is it we want access to justice and being able to voice our perspective so that people get treated justly? Do you think we have the wrong target? And if so, what might we be aiming at, and what, how might we get there?
This is it's a great question, this distinction between an end in itself and a means to an end. We have to pick our ends in themselves very carefully, because if something is elected to be an end in itself, you can never have enough of that. Whereas, so you can't measure it and you can't dole it out, or you can't, if there is this idea of people don't have enough freedom of speech, then it can't be an end in itself. It has to be a means to an end, because then you get enough of it to contribute to a conversation, whereas some people might have, you know, not enough or too much. They're talking over each other or being talked over. Having this limited, and not limited in the sense of not enough, but a bounded or a measured sense of freedom of speech, even if freedom of speech becomes something like an ideal where we want to aspire to it to be more than just a means to an end, at least provisionally, having a measured take to it might give us the intelligibility we need to be able to discuss it with each other.
The type of speech I would want to consider an end in and of itself would be speech that contributes to the conversation, speech that innovates, that gives people new options and new opportunities. one of the books that I have discussed on this program that had a big effect on me was reading the book Utopia, which is this discussion, which one of the things that I really appreciated about that book is that one of the things that makes Utopia Utopia is that there is a very strong emphasis on creating social harmony. So people who are young need to eat next to people who are older than them, than their elders. I do think that in Canada, if we create a better sense of social harmony, then more people, and the more people we have who are unable to participate in our society, and the better listeners we can be, the more of those innovative ideas we can adopt and use to make our society better.
You're right. And I think both of you, again, in a sense, said the same thing, because I think what you're saying, Aaron, is that you want something that contributes. And in that sense, something that contributes is a means. It's something that leads to other successes. And I think that really is where our civil discourse shines, is its ability, like you said, to innovate, to lead to other successes. And I think maybe what is happening is that I have a much stronger idea now of what speech needs to be in terms of quality to give me what I want out of my public engagement. And it's not about quantity. Maybe that's also a thing that people are focusing on too much. It's like, it's not about how many chances I have to say something out in public. It's about how much does this actually contribute to our lives? How good is the speech that we're engaging in? And so maybe there's a sense in which you could argue that free speech is dying because its quality is diminishing because of these mediums, because of all these things that we've talked about that are sort of making it difficult to talk to each other. But maybe it's alive and well because people like us are really pushing for civil discourse and really talking about the importance of it and realizing the importance of it, such that maybe people will find better ways to talk and prioritize those ways over others. So I want to say thank you to both of my co-hosts here today, Brendan Brunley and Aaron Wang, for joining me on this discussion about free speech in the Canadian context. My name is Mihai Kovacer. Thank you very much all for listening.
You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Please email us at hello@philosophyshow.ca.
October 30th to November 5th, CJSF is hosting our 5th annual fun drive, a celebration of our 20 years of shared awesomeness. As an awesome listener to your community radio station, you can expect a full week of heartfelt content. Be ready to donate to our campaign and let's be awesome together. Fundrive runs October 30th to November 5th. Donating to CJSF 90.1 FM's Fundrive is awesome, and so are you, which is why we think you're a perfect match for each other. Keep being awesome and donate now at cjsf.ca/donate to support your awesome community radio station, CJSF 90.1 FM.
You're listening to CJSF.